Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. James Curran makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Dr. Curran is Senior Lecturer in the Department of History and the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney, and he's the author of The Power of Speech, Australian Prime Minister's Defining the Nation, Defining the National Image, and also he's co-author with Stuart Ward of The Unknown Nation, Australia After Empire, and Dr. Curran spoke to the Sydney Institute about that book, which essentially covered the period of the governments of Holt and Gorton and McMahon leading up to the Whitlam government. But on this occasion, James Curran has returned to the Sydney Institute to talk about his most recent book, Curtin's Empire, which has been well received, including by Kim Beazley and Hugh White, who endorsed the book. And the topic for tonight's talk is John Curtin and the British Empire. James Curran, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks very much to Jared and to Anne again for having me here, and thanks for coming along tonight. Now, this year marks the 70th anniversary of John Curtin's Look to America statement published in the Melbourne Herald on the 27th of December 1941. That message contained the Australian government's plea for American support in the face of a rampant Japanese Imperial Army sweeping down through Southeast Asia. The strategic circumstances of the war at this time seemed to presage what Australian politicians and policymakers had long feared, that with Britain engaged in a European war, it would be unable to defend Australia against a military invasion by an Asian power. Curtin did not mince his words, writing that, and I quote, "Without any inhibitions of any kind, I make it quite clear that Australia looks to America, free of any pangs as to our traditional links or kinship with the United Kingdom." Now, those words have become an article of faith in the speeches of Labor Prime Ministers. Witness Julia Gillard's recent address to the United States Congress, where the ritual genuflection to Curtin's judgment yet again provided the historical anchor of Labor's alliance management credentials. Moreover, the statement for many years has acted as the canonical proof for those who have painted the portrait of Curtin as a leader fired by the spirit of nationalism, as much in historical scholarship as in the broader public culture. Yet it has been a long time since anyone claiming specialist expertise in the field has asserted that Curtin's statement remains the precise moment when Australia finally grasped the nettle of nationhood and cut its ties to Britain. Contrary to the generally accepted view, Curtin's look to America was not an epiphany of Australian independence and a rejection of the nation's Britishness, but an expedient call for help at a time when Australia feared the prospect of a Japanese invasion. Indeed, Prime Ministers Deakin, Lyons and Menzies had all previously appealed to the Americans to come to the defence of Australia. Now, Curtin's message, although it was pronounced in far more dramatic circumstances, was entirely consistent with the orthodox Australian foreign policy doctrine of searching for security in the Pacific. The Labor Prime Minister was adamant, as he went on to say in that statement, that the Pacific should not be treated as a subordinate part of the general conflict, and he declared, and I quote, that the Australian government therefore regards the Pacific struggle as primarily one in which the United States and Australia must have the fullest say in the direction of the democracy's fighting plan. More recently, even David Day, the historian who more than any other of recent times has given voice to a radical nationalist interpretation of Anglo-Australian conflict during World War II, conceded that by war's end, the statement had seemed to have left, he said, no lasting mark on Australia. Now, it's often forgotten, of course, you don't read this statement in the history books very often, that Curtin himself moved very quickly to assuage any fears that that statement should be taken as marking a fundamental break with Britain. Under a barrage of visceral verbal assault from his political opponents, one criticised the statement for its, quote, execrable choice of words, He convened a special press conference in Canberra only 2 days later, and he said this. He said, "There's no part of the empire more steadfast in loyalty to the British way of living and British institutions than Australia. Our loyalty to His Majesty the King goes to the very core of our national life. It's part of our being. I do not consider," he went on, "Australia to be a segment of the British Empire. It is an organic part of the whole structure. And I do not put Australia," he said, "in the position of a colony. Australia is a dominion." Now, Curtin's concern to stress Australia's position as a dominion in an organic whole was predicated on the view that all British peoples were equal and that all should contribute to the creation of a policy that would provide equal and absolute security for all the peoples of Greater Britain. While it might be tempting to see these comments as a pragmatic way of dampening down a domestic scuffle, Curtin went to great lengths as Prime Minister to give an institutional expression to his understanding of empire. Now, the book I've just published, Curtin's Empire, takes as its starting point this statement of 1941 to show that it has to some extent frozen this Labour leader in time, labelling him forever as the leader who locked horns with Churchill, refused to be bullied by the British, and who forged the alliance with the United States. But that has meant that his ideas about Australia and the Empire have been given less billing, as if they don't fit the nationalist mould into which he has been permanently cast. Indeed, it's almost as if Curtin's celebrated nationalism is seen as being fundamentally at odds with his periodic lapses into imperial patriotism, such as, for example, his appointment of the Duke of Gloucester as the Governor-General, or his defence of God Save the King, as he put it, as Australia's only national anthem. Because there remains a need, among some, to hold Curtin up as the great hero of Australian independence, in effect to ennoble him as Australia's George Washington, his commitment to Britain is often depicted as a strange anomaly. Now, I should stress that the approach that I take in the book is not biographical in the traditional sense. That is, I don't seek to offer here a picture of the life. Neither is it concerned with following the meandering tributaries of the history war controversies over whether or not there was a battle for Australia, whether the Japanese were intending to invade the country, or whether the British failure to hold Singapore constituted a great betrayal. Now, all of those arguments have produced a vibrant and a valuable historical debate. But when they explode into the public sphere, they so often fall victim to the short-term imperatives of domestic politics or the hysteria of populist national mythology. Rather, the book aims to show how John Curtin came to see himself as the architect of a new form of empire. He called it an empire council or an imperial secretariat, and why he thought that this new phase of imperial cooperation was going to be an inevitable development in the post-war world. And in the book, I trace out the deeply laid and culturally rich sources of Curtin's proposal for a more closely integrated concept of empire in the post-war era as one way of illustrating the centrality of Britishness in Australian ideas of selfhood at this time. As a Labour man of Irish Catholic descent who'd been an anti-conscriptionist leader in World War I, Curtin is an excellent anti-intuitive subject for this purpose. Moreover, in the book I attempt to show that his attitude to Britishness and empire were not the eccentric initiative of a maverick, but a response to the world drawn from widely held beliefs about national identity. Now, throughout the 1920s and 30s, before Curtin became Prime Minister, both he and the Labour Party had been living with the aftershocks arising from the bitter conscription referenda of 1916 and 17. And the party had split, and its credibility on questions relating to international affairs, especially its attitude to empire, had been brought into question. During that period, many in Labour ranks nurtured deep suspicions of being entrapped in another imperial war in which the Australian people would have no say. And as a result, their conservative opponents ruthlessly exploited Labour's internal divisions and tagged the party as disloyal to empire, a label that undermined Labour's claims to be defender and protector of the national interest. Despite these frictions, however, Labour's political troubles on these international questions never developed into a full-blown platform of anti-Britishness, and separation from the mother country, as it was put by the inauguration of an Australian Republic, was never placed on the party platform. That had to wait until the 1990s. It's testament to the deep currents of British race patriotism in Australia's political culture at this time that no leader or senior figure in the federal parliamentary Labour Party could hope to be elected in adopting such a stance. Now, the book shows, I think, that the empire was a subject of vibrant debate in Australian political culture at this time, a debate which was not about the empire's inherent validity, this was a given, but about how it could be reinvigorated or made to work better so that it could provide security for all parts of the empire. In short, what I'm seeking to map here is the Labour brand of Britishness. What Curtin had shown, both as a young firebrand writing editorials for the West Australian Worker, as a parliamentarian and as a leader of the Labour Party, was a resentment of those who saw the monarchy as the head of a class-based society, and a resentment against those who craved the privileges of an imperial aristocracy. Labour did not reject the fundamental tenets of being part of the British race, but they did reject the conservative militarist patriotism that often went with it. Labour challenged the motives of those who showed themselves to be overzealous in proclaiming their loyalty to the throne and who seemed intent on using the crown as a political weapon against the Labour movement. Curtin often railed against what he saw as the turgid oratory for which Empire Day provides the excuse. He complained about people who he thought suffered the disease of imperialitis. He was in despair at being, as he put it, manacled to the blatant screamers of loyalty. And complained about the debate over empire in the 1920s, where there was talk of imperial conferences and mandates. But what did this all mean for Australia? Did it mean that Australia was being treated as an equal? He felt Australia was being treated as a subordinate, as a colony, and it wasn't good enough. Okay, so he had an idea, even in the 20s, I think, of how the empire ought to work, how it ought to work better to protect Australian interests. Now, there can be little doubt that the 1940s were tempestuous times in Anglo-Australian relations. Of course, the fall of Singapore and the ensuing cable battle with Churchill are often seen as marking a fundamental rupture with Britain. But equally, it might be argued that the war only intensified Australia's sense of geopolitical fragility and therefore motivated the Australian leaders to reinvigorate the imperial connection, to bolster the system of imperial defence, even though it had been seen as a failure, obviously, with the fall of Singapore. The great aim of post-war reconstruction was to attain the levels of economic growth and full employment necessary for Australia to fulfil its strategic and economic efficiency. In April of 1942, Curtin broadcast to the people of Britain, and he defined Australians, he said, as a people who were practical empire patriots and practical democrats. Now, by laying the stress on the practical, I think he was giving voice to a language of Britishness that Labour could make its own, one which underlined the benefits to Australia and avoided the flowery imperial oratory for which he had no patience. In that speech, he even lauded the fact that Australia had been, as he put it, the first empire people to send their men away from their shores to fight for the empire, words that would have been simply unthinkable for a Labour leader to have contemplated uttering in the 1930s. By the middle of 1943, however, as the country prepared for a federal election, it was clear that the tide of the war had, for the most part, turned for the better, to the point where Curtin was being forced to rebut accusations that he'd been overstating the dimension of the crisis facing the nation. He now had the chance to take on the role of statesman and to give a serious attention to the role that Australia would play in the post-war world. Now, in so doing, he became part of a broader debate that was occurring in London and other empire capitals about how Britain was going to maintain its post-war power and influence alongside that of the United States and the Soviet Union. The English historian Richard Toy has shown that Churchill viewed the concept of the English-speaking peoples as one way to preserve British influence in a world in which growing American power was a reality. And the imperial unity of the kind that followed the outbreak of war in 1939 and the material and psychological support that the Dominions afforded to Britain in the 12 months following June 1940 was thought by some to constitute the linchpin of Britain's claims to be one of the Big Three. Or in the words of one British Conservative politician, the British Commonwealth was the epitome of interdependence, the very model, he said, of binding together a vast community of peoples. Other empire enthusiasts in London were giving speeches emphasising that a more united, closely integrated empire was a prerequisite for Britain maintaining a powerful voice in world affairs. As John Darwin has concluded, the renewed talk amongst British leaders of imperial unity and a common foreign policy for the empire may have owed something to Curtin. I think that's a tentative conclusion. I think it owed quite a bit to Curtin. For the Labor Prime Minister, the idea of an Empire Council, that is a body that would provide for full and continuous consultation between London and the Dominions, and which would circulate around the Empire. In other words, this was not to be an Empire Council that would be araldited to London and Whitehall. It was to be a body that would move around the Empire so there could be meetings in Ottawa, in Pretoria, in Canberra, in Wellington. In other words, the Empire that is truly organic and representative of its constituent parts. For Curtin, it seemed to be that arrangement the only and obvious answer to the problems thrown up by the war. He could not believe but that the Empire should be able to accomplish the protection of all parts of the British world if only the right policies and processes were adopted. Now, a central part of Curtin's job in bringing the Labor Party along with this plan was to convince them that the days of isolationism were over. And he'd already proceeded some distance in changing the party's mindset on these questions. Against much vociferous internal opposition, he was successful in introducing conscription for overseas service in the Southwest Pacific Theatre in January 1943. Speaking to the New South Wales Labor Party conference later that year, he told his colleagues, he said, "The world can never be the same in the years to come in problems of defence and security as it was in the year before this war started. Australia," he said, "had to be a Pacific power for our own security." And of course, he followed this up by saying that Australia had to have available the advantage of concerted empire policy if she's to be a power to stand for democracy in the South Pacific. So the two went hand in hand, Pacific interests and a new empire council. And when Curtin provided a confidential briefing to Australian journalists on his plans for this empire council, he placed it firmly within the context of rebuilding British honour and credibility in Australia's part of the world. Here's what he said to the journalists. "British prestige suffered a bad knock in the Far East. I not only regret that, but I want to retrieve it. The British Commonwealth of Nations has got to have economic strength as well as the unity which the throne symbolises. We've got to keep in mind all the time the sovereign symbol with autonomous rights." He said, "I want to develop a practical fraternity amongst constituted members of the empire for dealing with the world at large and with themselves. Perhaps," he said, "that sounds a loose sort of show, but the fact is that the ties which unite the British Commonwealth are of that nature and no less weak because that is the case." Okay, but I think this idea of practical fraternity is very interesting. Here, Curtin is attempting to marry these two worlds of sentiment and self-interest that had dominated Anglo-Australian relations from the late 19th century. It was also another more precise indication of what he meant by this idea of the Australian people being practical empire patriots. But the comments, I mean, in other words, in essence, its desire was to make the empire work better for Australia and to do it in a way that would not make the country subordinate to Britain. But the comments also suggested an emerging difficulty for Curtin in making the case for greater cooperation. The tension between the respect for the sovereign rights of individual nations and a desire for the cultivation of common ideas for the empire would prove difficult to resolve. And like those prime ministers before him who had also argued the case for some sort of imperial machinery, Curtin seemed to think that the creation of this council was a fait accompli. His contention that, as he put it, machinery to give effect to what I'm sure will be recognised as an inevitable post-war development would appear to be easy to devise, showed that he'd not looked at past experience and as a result did not foresee the difficulties that would arise from his proposals. Many other Commonwealth leaders and commentators would view it as neither inevitable or easy. For them, Curtin's plan defied the patterns of development in the British Commonwealth during the 1920s and 1930s, which of course had stressed the right of all dominions to have their own foreign policy. Curtin was cutting against the grain of the way in which the British Commonwealth had evolved. Now, the former Canadian High Commissioner to Australia, Major General Victor Odlum, who was a friend of Curtin, wrote him a personal note once Curtin started to speak about this Empire Council proposal, and he heaped praise on him for giving the lead, as he put it, and setting the pace on the question of an Empire Council. But these were the sweeteners before the medicine. Odlum then stressed that Curtin needed to answer one critical question for his proposals to make headway across the empire, namely, what is to be the authority of the council over the dominions? And for good measure, Odlum stated Canada was determined to remain within the empire, but she's got no intention of being told by others, even though they might be members of the same family, what she is to do unless she has previously agreed that she'll accept the direction. Now, this was why, of course, the Canadian government had, throughout the 1920s and 30s, backed the demands for autonomy and backed away, like South Africa, from the idea of a common imperial policy for the empire. Now, of course, Curtin had avoided this difficult question. He said that the Empire Council would not project any authority, it would be merely consultative. But this is a fascinating source, because here is his response in private correspondence to his friend, where he makes the connection between his arguments at that time for an Empire Council and the reaction which greeted the 1941 Look to America statement. He says to Odlum, "I may say to you that had there been such a council in existence, my appeals to the United States would not have been subjected to the misunderstanding in Australia and in Great Britain which marked them, because the facts would have been better within the knowledge of Canada and of the United Kingdom, for instance, than appeared to have been the case." In other words, what he meant was that if this ideal system of imperial cooperation had been in position, by its nature, each side would have understood what the other was doing and would have reacted sympathetically. And there would have been a realisation that such an approach to a foreign power was not a danger to the unity of the empire. I think the significance of that source cannot be understated. Previously, Australian scholars have had only Curtin's public statements refuting the misunderstanding of his Look to America statement. Here in private, he was saying that it had all been a complete mix-up. But it was Curtin's address to the Federal Conference of the Australian Labor Party in December 1943 that represented the high point in his campaign to win popular and party support for his plan. In that speech, he held up the British Commonwealth as a model for any future world society of nations. It had, he said, exemplified to the world how autonomous nations can collaborate on matters of mutual interest. Now, he then laid out an interpretation of the history of the British Empire as it had evolved to the early 1950s. But this is the interesting point, that Curtin not only proposes an Empire Council, but he has a history to go with it. He said that the British peoples were in the midst of a transition to a new stage of empire. He had a four-empire history. The first British Empire, he said, related the early days of colonisation and came to an end with the revolt of the American colonies. The Second Empire had lasted until the Great War, and the Third Empire was defined by the Imperial Conference of 1926. But in Curtin's history, the British peoples were now on the cusp of a Fourth Empire, in which, he said, the trend was to augment an association of independent sovereign peoples by a common policy in matters that concern the empire as a whole. Now, the essence of Curtin's new proposals lay in their insistence that Australia's views should be taken into account right from the outset in the making of imperial policy. There were systems in place already to try and make sure that that happened, but it rarely worked. The Dominion High Commissioners would have regular meetings with the Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs, but there was no formal body in the imperial system that had as its purpose the task of ensuring Dominion views were considered before decisions were made. And it was this gap that the Imperial Council was intended to fill. And he wanted a permanent secretariat. He wanted a group of public servants, essentially, to prepare papers and to accompany this imperial secretariat as it ambulated around the empire. Curtin's proposal received the overwhelming endorsement of his party, with barely a ripple of disagreement in the conference ranks. For a party that had torn itself apart over conscription in the First World War, and which had adopted an isolationist policy in the 1930s, and taken to the 1937 election a policy of continental defence, this was significant. Indeed, for Labor, it might be seen as something of a transmogrification. And while Curtin was in a stronger political position following his win at the 1943 election, nevertheless he'd been giving voice to this British Empire argument prior to that poll and without serious dissent from his party. The ideas that Curtin was proposing, the very same ideas that Labor had rejected when Billy Hughes had earlier expounded them, were now seen as a credible means of emphasising the equality of all Britons and their capacity to act as one people in the world. The suggestion that Curtin's speech was crafted to win popularity has no substance. All the evidence points to the conclusion that he had totally embraced the view of a fourth empire. Indeed, he was advocating the sorts of plans that would normally have been associated with Labor's domestic political enemies. Labor's empire spirit, as the political correspondent Ross Gollan noted in his conference review, needed to be taken seriously. As Golan said, as an addition to conventional Labor doctrine of 1917 to 1939, the resolution has to be considered a new and shining revelation, a winning post in the road away from isolationism. And Golan added that, quote, enough shades of Labor thought were represented among delegates to make it clear that any other representative Labor conference would have carried an identical motion. And only one tiny working class wing, he said, had trouble in swallowing the fact that in peace as in war, Australia's destiny is that as a member of the British Commonwealth. And of course that a dissent that took the form of a bruising riposte from Jack Lang. Elsewhere, the mainstream press mostly came to praise Curtin. Sydney Morning Herald argued that the Prime Minister was on the right side of history, judging that whilst the evolution of the Commonwealth has been away from constitutional rigidity, it said, it may be that this process has gone far enough and that under the impulse of the war and faced with the problems of a new world, we're about to witness a reaction towards a more closely knit and cooperative British Commonwealth. Now, the opposition leader, Robert Menzies, was not so much sceptical about Curtin's plans as incredulous. He could not treat Curtin as anything other than an imposter in the world of high imperial politics, a veritable Johnny-come-lately to the world of high empire politics. Thus he dismissed the conference speech, Menzies said, as nothing new and a complete disappointment. He could not view the proposals as anything but a cynical attempt by Curtin to recast himself as an empire statesman. In Menzies' eyes, all Curtin had done was to restate at great length the principles upon which empire relations had been maintained for many years. But I would argue that Menzies no more understood how loyalty to Britain was the culture of Labour than that his own side's sometimes assertive and uncritical embrace of British leadership was itself a partisan expression of Britishness. Thus, even though he welcomed the Secretariat proposal, Menzies concluded that Curtin was merely theorising, as Menzies said, that he was theorising about these matters. In other words, he was depicting them as lacking proper respect and respect for and belief in the mother country. For Menzies, the habits of consultation and collaboration were well established. He said, our relations with empire countries had for many years been based upon the view that there should be a full exchange of information and that wherever possible, knowledge should be obtained in time to express opinions before decisions were taken. Now, Menzies seemed to assume that this had been the case when clearly it was not. Now, Curtin, to cut a long story short, and it's detailed extensively in the book, was not deterred by the mounting opposition to his plan from his Dominion colleagues, especially the Canadian Mackenzie King and the South African Smuts. British officials who'd seen these proposals so many times before from Australian Prime Ministers expressed embarrassment at having virtually to shelve them once again. Nor was he put off course, Curtin, by the fact that Churchill and Smuts were both absent from the session at the 1944 Prime Ministers' Conference in London at which he presented his ideas. At the meeting, however, Curtin reminded his British hosts of the crisis that his country had faced in meeting the Japanese threat. In his opening statement, he made no apology for asking for American assistance when Australia, he said, had been seriously threatened by Japan. The result, he said, was that a continent which was an integral part of the British Empire and was occupied and defended by British people had been held through a period of grave peril. And he added that the acceptance of this assistance from the United States had, and I quote, in no way affected the Australians' deep sense of oneness with the United Kingdom. Now, essentially what Curtin walked away from that meeting was not the proposal for an Empire Council. As I said, that was shelved. They did agree to have daily meetings of the High Commissioners, the Dominion High Commissioners, with the Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs, and even a monthly meeting with the British Prime Minister. But that practice very soon fell into abeyance. The large part of Curtin's proposals were interred in that most bureaucratic of graveyards, the Technical Committee. The rebuttal in London, however, and I'm moving towards my conclusion, the rebuttal in London did nothing, however, to weaken Curtin's passionate commitment to empire. Even in the face of great disappointment at seeing his proposals effectively shelved, Curtin showed once again that for Australian leaders, the powerful urgings of British race patriotism made it difficult for them to bring their disagreements with Britain into the open. In his Empire Day speech, broadcast from London only days after the conference concluded, Curtin said, and I quote, the Australian people are a replica of Britain and their way of life in Britain. In the Southern Hemisphere, he went on, 7 million Australians carry on a British community as trustees for the British way of life in a part of the world where it is of the utmost significance to the British-speaking race, and that's how he defined Australia, a bastion of the British-speaking race, that such a vast continent should have its population, a people, and a form of government corresponding in outlook and its purpose to Britain. But these affirmations of Australia's continued prestige within a wider British world cannot hide the fact that, like Deakin, Hughes and Bruce before him, Curtin too had failed in his attempt to acquire for Australia a more intimate place in the councils of imperial decision-making. Though he had his own history of the British Commonwealth's evolution that convinced him that such a development was both natural and inevitable, he too became a captive of that past and indeed added another chapter to it. So let me, in closing, just return to the original problem. Why has John Curtin's particular view of Australian Britishness been so consistently overlooked or dismissed? The nationalist myth surrounding Curtin has served to obscure one of the defining features of the nation's political culture in the 20th century, its overwhelmingly British character. Moreover, it fails to acknowledge that the imperial idea struck distinctive roots in the Australian experience, one that proved in many respects to be at odds with the prevailing views of the meaning and purpose of empire in Britain and elsewhere. Britishness was not only at the heart of Australian foreign policy, both sides of politics agreed that it was at the centre of their national existence. Indeed, they believed that Britishness itself was both more pervasive and pure in Australia than in Britain itself. Where they differed was on how that idea should be expressed and who was better placed to articulate Australia's interests within the empire. From the end of the 19th century down to the 1960s, each party voiced their own distinctive variants on the rhetoric, symbolism and ritual of the imperial ideal. And the effect of this political discord was significant. It not only cast Labour as the outcasts of loyalty, thus putting them on the defensive for nearly two decades in the 1920s and 1930s, it meant that neither side of politics could treat foreign and defence policy on its own terms. Curtin's imperial sensibilities were homegrown, but the empire was no spectre that taunted him from afar. It was an idea and a philosophy that animated him from within. He might not have grown up imbibing the stories of imperial heroism contained in W.H. Fitchett's Deeds That Won the Empire, but he could quote at will from English poets, speak eloquently of the need to defend British liberty, and envisage a productive trade union movement working within the empire. That story in itself, I think, is quite remarkable. Curtin had cut his political teeth in the rough and tumble of the labour movement. His eyes for so long firmly fixed on the bread and butter issues of improving the lives and lot of the ordinary Australian. And yet as a national political leader he came to promote the idea of closer empire cooperation, giving voice to a distinctive rhetoric of Australia as a bastion of the British-speaking race. On the opening day of the Prime Minister's Conference in London in May 1944, the Times of London could not have put it more succinctly. Mr. Curtin's convictions, it said, concerning the place of the British Commonwealth in the world, are the deeper for having been acquired not from textbooks on British political institutions, but in the hard school of political experience. Throughout his time in representative politics, it was one thing for Curtin and Labour to disagree with the policies of successive Conservative governments in Britain. It was quite another for them to suggest that Australia ought to break free from Britain entirely. Curtin and his party never seriously entertained such a prospect. Indeed, standing side by side with Britain as a proud dominion in the face of totalitarianism was a story that Labour could be proud of, and it was a form of cooperation that they wanted to see continued, albeit one where Australia's equality was formally enshrined in a new form of imperial organisation. Curtin's arguments, therefore, for an empire council suggest that the key lesson for Australians as they emerged from the Pacific War was not one about the need for national emancipation. Rather, it was that Australia was a part of a wider, dangerous world, and that as a British people, they ought to be able to find their security through a common imperial defence and foreign policy. The reality, however, was that both political parties for too long pursued an illusion, believing that Britain would naturally and inevitably acquiesce to Australia's desire for a greater say in the empire's affairs. But it was not to be. Australians were forced to acknowledge that an enlightened concept of the empire's affairs burned brightest at the periphery and not in the imperial centre. It would take nothing less than the post-war collapse of British power around the globe and the rapid decline of the British Empire for Australians to begin in earnest the task of resetting the coordinates of their foreign policy and the process of remaking their national image. Thank you.
Many thanks, James Curran. Thanks also to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this facility today. And so we come to question and discussion. We have an unusual academic who can speak for 30 minutes rather than 50 minutes, so I commend you on that, which means we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. Can I just lead off where you started with Curtin's article in the Melbourne Herald of the 27th of December 1941. There is some suggestion you'll be aware of that this might have been prepared by a press secretary and that Curtin may have signed off without deeply considering it. I mean, what's the story about who actually wrote the first draft? Do we know that?
I don't know whether it's actually the story of the first draft, whether it's actually been sufficiently documented. I mean, it is widely believed that Don Rogers did write the draft. Who was his press secretary. I mean, the view I take on this, as I did on many of the speeches that I looked at in a previous book on Australian Prime Ministers, is that once the Australian Prime Minister puts his name to it, they are his words. And I think the key point, too, is that when you get beyond the hysterical reaction to those words, from Percy Spender, Robert Menzies, Billy Hughes. I mean, Billy Hughes is interesting, actually, because he said that, it would be a false and suicidal policy for Australia to think that the help they would get from Great Britain was any less than the help they would get from another great power. But he recognised what Curtin wanted. He looked at the statement in its entirety and said, well, what Curtin wants here is a place at the high table of policy making. He wants the Pacific to be treated equally. So in many ways, I think it reflected this Australian frustration that the Beat Hitler First strategy was overtaking their concerns in the Pacific. So I think it's vintage Curtin, but I also think, as I said, that it's a restatement in many ways of the previous Australian Prime Ministers looking to America to guarantee their security. Deakin in 1907, with the Great White Fleet, wanted the Munro Doctrine for the South Pacific to be extended to include Australia. The British government wouldn't have a bar of it, and neither would the Americans. Joe Lyons took the Pacific Pact proposal to 1937 Imperial Conference, which had a similar aim, and again got nowhere with it. So I think it's the elements of continuity in it that I think are perhaps important to stress, but I think it's pure Curtin.
Taking that bit further, in mind, the real achievement of Curtin, and I think his legacy has been hijacked by the hero worship, and therefore what you've done is very valuable, because he's very much against non-English speaking, non-Anglo immigration in 1938. He had a very good speech about that.
Yep.
But isn't his real achievement to have sold it to the Labor Party?
Yes.
And to what extent are successive Labor leaders want to get that experience of the massive Australian conservatism bubbling up and forcing them to that sort of moment where they have to convince their own colleagues that there's no value in being red-ragged.
Yeah, well, that's right. Look, I think that the... I mean, it's often stated that Labor leaders have to walk a rather tricky path through factional intrigue. The job that Curtin had as the leader of the Labor Party and as the alternative Prime Minister in the 1930s was extraordinary. I mean, the factional sort of discord was quite significant. I mean, on the one hand, he had liberal internationalists who look to the League of Nations as the great institutional expression of world harmony and peace and the brotherhood of man. Then he had Catholics who hated communism, saw it as the enemy of religion. He had international socialists who looked to the Soviet Union as the model of world leadership. And he had isolationists who simply wanted to turn their backs on the world altogether. Now, Curtin, I think, did manage to bring those factions together and to give Labor a credible and coherent foreign policy. Now, I think the sad part of it, obviously, well, the reality is that during the 1930s, they really didn't provide the Labor Party did not provide a credible opposition to the government on foreign affairs. I mean, if you look at their response to the Abyssinian crisis or the Spanish Civil War, they had no policy, basically. Curtin had to try and navigate through the shoals of all these religious, ideological and political fissures in the Labor Party. So bringing them along on these questions, and as I said, he had an early victory over conscription, albeit conscription to defend Australia in the Southwest Pacific area, and then to get unanimity at this conference is quite remarkable. I mean, I think it just shows you the patience with which Curtin went about arguing his case. He made a number of speeches about where he saw the empire going, where he saw Australia's post-war policy going, why the Australian Labor Party needed to readjust its international vision, and gradually brought the people and the party along with him. So, I would agree. I mean, this is an amazing achievement for the leader of the Labor Party. I mean, that I did speak very briefly there about that opposition which came from Lang. Let me just read to you what Lang said. He thought the whole Empire Council...
Hang on. Lang being the Labor Premier of New South Wales, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. Indeed. And who was taking pot shots at Curtin right throughout the war. Lang said that he saw this whole... He believed that Labor had been hoodwinked by Curtin at the conference and that they didn't really understand what they were signing up for. He said this was just a stalking horse for Imperial Federation. The imperialists, he said, welcome. This is a golden opportunity to get their long-wanted Imperial Federation. Never has an Australian government been in such a sycophantic mood. Whenever a kitty hawk flies over Canberra, officialdom fervently murmurs, God bless America. On the rare occasions when a Spitfire appears, they just as fervently mutter, God bless England. Should anybody be heard to say, God bless Australia, he is scowled at as a heretical isolationist, an anachronism from the horse and buggy age. Okay, so he said that Curtin had actually become ashamed of the name Australian and that they should rename the party the Australian Imperial Party. So, yes, it was vociferous, and there were some editors of Labor newspapers who didn't like to see their idols sort of be lopped off so quickly, but it was unanimously endorsed at that party conference.
Before we go to the next question, I should have said that we've got some copies of Curtin's Empire by James Curran, which are over there. So, Jeff.
James, it doesn't surprise me so much that Curtin would, as Prime Minister, adopt a policy that has the continuity about which you spoke.
Mm-hmm.
But was Menzies right that Curtin was a Johnny-come-lately to that policy? Do we detect, or when do you say you can detect when Curtin did have those views about the empire? I mean, for instance, when he was writing for the West Australian Worker, does it come out of that, or is it something a bit later?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Look, the fascinating thing is that in the 1920s, he's basically saying, I think we should go the path of Canada and South Africa, who in the aftermath of the First World War had said, look, we want more freedom to enter into treaties under our own steam and to make our own foreign policy. We don't want to be inevitably caught up in empire's wars. And for Curtin, that was the way the empire should be going. It should be decentralising. Okay, he also spoke a lot in the 1920s the ignominy of Australia being treated as a subordinate, as a colony. So there's a great frustration that London financiers and British politicians, particularly conservative politicians, are basically taking Australia's independence away. And really, I mean, he is quite the radical nationalist in the 1920s. Throughout the 1930s, I think you can see a subtle change. I mean, it should be said, even though he's criticising the empire in the 1920s, as I said, he never really argues for a fundamental break. Okay, this is all about how can we make the empire work better. In the 1930s, the language does adjust. I mean, he starts to talk about, we've got to defend this country and all the British investment that's here. This is British territory. He questions the reliance on the Singapore strategy and argues for more continental defence. But again, he's wanting to look for ways to make the empire better. I think the really interesting part of this too is the advice that he receives from Sir Frederick Shedden. Now, Sir Frederick Shedden, head of the Defence Department, he's Curtin's top advisor on defence and foreign policy. Now, he had the nickname of the Pocket Hanky because he was a great devotee and a protege of Sir Maurice Hanky, who was the British Imperial Cabinet's secretary. And Hanky had spent his life devoted to the study of imperial defence and how to make it work better. And so I think Sheridan sees this as a great opportunity that he can advise a Labor Prime Minister to get more credibility on Empire Affairs. And Sheridan is also very conscious of all the various different strands in the Australian Labor Party and what Curtin needs to do to win support. It's quite interesting advice, but the bit that Sheridan leaves out is the fact that Fisher, Deakin, Hughes, Bruce and others had tried and failed to get this ideal machinery for the Empire. Okay, there are numerous examples. It wouldn't have been a very happy brief for John Curtin to read. But Sheridan spoke about steering him in the safe course of Empire cooperation. He said, look, there's a lot of talk about this World Society of Nations and evolving the United Nations. It's all this liberal internationalist talk. But the fact of the matter is, Sheridan said, you'll find it much easier to make progress on Empire cooperation. So, the trajectory is quite important. I don't think he has a Paulian conversion or anything like that. I think he does become a convert to imperial defence, though. Okay, he's a critic of it in the 30s, and he's a supporter of it very much so in the war and for the post-war period.
Question here. My father-in-law, who fought the Japanese in New Guinea, and was the last standing, so to speak, because everybody around him was killed, told me that at one stage a British politician said that Australians make very good cannon fodder. Now, who was the politician and who reacted? Was it John Curtin who reacted to this?
Well, look, I mean, I have heard that statement before. I can't give you the name, unfortunately, of who actually said it, but it does remind me a little bit of what Sir Winston Churchill said after he'd heard that Look to America statement, that Australians came of bad stock. Okay, he was deeply insulted by that comment. All right, now, Churchill was one who said, look, successive Australian governments have simply not prepared enough for their own defence, and they adopted a policy of appeasement. Okay, so he laid the blame squarely at the Australian governments, whereas one could equally argue that British assurances throughout the late 20s and the 1930s about the British base at Singapore were pretty rock solid, although by the late 1930s there was some equivocation. I think this idea of cannon fodder has also been used for the Canadians as well. I mean, it pricks a very sensitive bubble in the Australian psyche that Australians are simply being thrown to the wolves in imperialist wars. I mean, that argument is made by the left when it talks about World War I and Gallipoli and the Western Front to undermine the legitimacy of Australia going to war in the first place. You know, there's no Australian interests when you make that argument. It's just, you know, there they go, you mow them down, and, we're the subordinates of empire.
So it's possible the statement was never made.
It is possible. I have heard someone refer to it before, but I just can't put my finger on the name, I'm sorry.
Thanks very much for that. You mentioned the illusion of both parties. Do you think there was a total failure of Australia's leadership to appreciate the deep-seated English approach in Australia, which still exists today, which are their colonials? They know nothing, we know everything. Much like the American approach to the failure to take Australia properly and seriously for what we've contributed.
Oh, look, I think there is an element of that. I mean, certainly, if you are to look at the passage of successive Australian Prime Ministers to London from the early 20th century right through to the late 1940s, each of them, it's as if each of them are saying, next time it'll work. And next time it will be different. And Neville Meany has made this argument very persuasively, I think, that there's this belief that if only the circumstances are right, then we can have a common imperial policy and we will be treated equally and we will be taken into the higher councils of foreign policy making for the empire. I think Australians were quite successful, on the other hand, in making the British aware of their own particular geopolitical interests that arose out of their particular geographical position. I think there were moments when Australia went against all the advice of the Committee for Imperial Defence, the Foreign Office, the Commonwealth Office, the Admiralty. Okay, you know, when you look at Australian policy before the First World War, with the Defence Act, with the creation of the Army, the creation of the Navy, these were even with the adoption of the White Australia policy. I mean, a lot of these measures were points of disagreement with the British government. So, I mean, I don't think you can totally sort of underestimate the success that Australian leaders had in making the British aware of their interests. But perhaps the mistake was to always believe that the British would necessarily want to involve a dominion in the making of policy. The British had their own particular interests, okay, and Australians sometimes failed to grasp that. And so they kept knocking their head on a door that simply just wouldn't open in that sense. I mean, in the First World War, David Lloyd George established an Imperial War Cabinet, and there was a great sense of relief, particularly among Billy Hughes. This at last was the sort of machinery that we wanted. Okay, Australia would be there in the room and be given a chance to contribute to the making of policy. But when Hughes was left out of the Imperial War Cabinet's deliberations over the Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, he labelled that Imperial War Cabinet as a farce and a sham. So there's this constant history of going to London with proposals for closer cooperation, but inevitable disappointment. But it still doesn't stop the prosecution of distinctively Australian interests.
Right, so there's one, two, three.
Most of my adult life, I've naively thought it all happened in 1901 with the birth of independent nation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only in recent years that I've learned of the 1931 Statute of Westminster, in which Britain, to its credit, actually offered the white dominions anyhow complete equality with.
That's right.
And all the dominions had to do, well, the selected dominions had to do, was enact that statute in their own parliament. Why did it take Australia 12 years to enact that statute?
Well, yes, a good point. I mean, before the 1926 Imperial Conference, I mean, this is what I mean with Curtin and his statement about the Fourth Empire being an inevitable development and trending towards an increased cooperation cut against the grain of how the empire had evolved in the 1920s and 30s. Before the 1926 Imperial Conference, out of which came the Balfour Declaration, which became the basis for the Statute of Westminster, Stanley Melbourne Bruce feared that if the Empire codified the rights of the Dominions in a formal statement, in other words, if they were put down in black and white, he feared, what he said, the disintegration of the wider British nation. Australians did not want to fend off the imperial embrace in a way that the Canadians and the South Africans and the Irish Free State did. Okay, so there's a great sort of fear. Hughes expressed it in 1921 when Smuts tried to do the same thing. In other words, codify the autonomous status of the Dominions. You know, Australians wanted to keep open the channels of imperial policy. So it was only over, as you say, an obscure maritime shipping incident in 1942 that the Statute of Westminster was ratified in Australia. There was a great reluctance, I think, because Australians feared that once you do that, then you lose the avenue and the path to influence at the heart of empire.
There's an argument that even though we didn't ratify it, pretty much we were behaving, and so with Britain, in a way as if we had.
Mm-hmm.
And the application is a classic example
of
that. I mean, Australia was treated equally with all the others, and we had a very powerful influence in the role of what how the British government regarded
yes.
the application.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would argue too that Australia was acting as a sovereign, independent nation well before this. I mean, just because it doesn't have the institutional forms of a foreign policy, because it didn't have, you know, a building with the Department of External Affairs written all over it, doesn't mean that Australia didn't have a foreign policy of its own. I would argue from the late 19th century that Australia was articulating, the colonies then and then the Commonwealth, were articulating distinctive interests arising out of particular geopolitical anxieties, and that brought them into conflict with the mother country. Okay, the trick is, I think, to unravelling this dilemma is to see that there's this web of culture that closes in over disagreements between Australia and Britain. Okay, that there was this sense about not wanting to air dirty laundry in public. This is a family. Families have disagreements, but they keep them within the family. They don't air it out in public. Okay. I think this tension between what you might call the community of culture Australia's overwhelming sentimental, emotional and cultural identification with the United Kingdom versus the community of interest. That is, the interests that derive from its position in the world and where it is geographically. That tension, I think, is the key to unlocking this problem.
I've got to be very brief, and I've caught two people, so it's one here.
Do you see an echo of all of this to some extent in the intelligence sharing arrangements that exist between Commonwealth countries and the United States? Extended into the English-speaking thing, and of course many would say that East Coast Americans are very anglophilic in their approach to life, although they're reluctant to admit it.
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, it is interesting how in recent years, and particularly since the decision to go to war in Iraq, with this idea of Australia being some part of some sort of Anglosphere has been revived. But I note that even John Howard turned his back on that, simply because I think he thought it carried too much old imperial baggage. As for the intelligence sharing, yes, look, there's no doubt. I mean, I had a couple of years as an analyst in the Office of National Assessment, so I was a beneficiary of that relationship. You know, we used to read the reports from the Joint Intelligence Committee.
It happens in education and law, too.
Look, the institutional forms of the relationship are still very much there. But I think, the process from, the 1960s and 70s, where the economic and the defence nexus, with British government moving into the EEC and withdrawing its military from the east of Suez, I think these were the profound shocks that changed that relationship forever. And that's when you get this problem of how to remould the Australian national image.
Final question.
Where do you see the Anzac agreement with in January 44 with this? Because here he is preaching cooperation, consultation,
yep.
Yet he goes to the New Zealanders and totally puts Washington offside by this action. It seems there's an inherent contradiction. I wonder whether there's an alternative reading that this is a man reaching out for whoever will support him as a Pacific power rather than wedded to a particular structure.
Could you just correct around that question, I think?
Well, the question is about the Anzac Pact, which was signed by Australia and New Zealand in January of 1944, and which created regional zones of defence. In effect, Australia and New Zealand were saying that they would be the principal guarantors of security in the Pacific area, and it was done without any prior consultation with London and Washington. I think it arose from Australian frustration that they'd been kept out at the Cairo Conference of 1943, where Churchill and Roosevelt and others had made decisions concerning Pacific policy. Look, I think Evatt was the one who was given the primary carriage. Evatt was kept very much out of the Empire Council strategy. The reality again is that Australia and New Zealand didn't get very far. I mean, I agree with you that there's an expediency in searching around for the great power, but I think it's one thing to say that about the look to America. I don't think it's an expedient move to then go and make arguments about an Empire Council. But, the Americans in particular were perturbed by the Anzac Pact of January 1944, and the Australians had called for a conference of US, UK and European powers to discuss regional security. And the Americans, of course, didn't sign up to that, and nor did the British. So it too didn't get very far, but I think, again, it was an expression of that frustration at being left out. And effectively, this again was a recurrence of Australia wanting to establish a kind of Munro Doctrine for the South Pacific. And in fact, the American ambassador to Australia defined it in those terms. The record of the meeting between Curtin and Roosevelt is very interesting on that. When Curtin goes to Washington before he goes to London for that Empire Conference, Roosevelt and Cordell Hull give him a roasting on it. What the hell were you thinking? And Curtin backtracks somewhat. Oh, it's all Evatt. It's crazy. Evatt's idea.
pretty rough. there were a couple of other questions, but we have a rule of finishing on 7 o'clock, and I shouldn't break it. So many thanks to James Curran for a fine paper on John Curtin and the British Empire. I think it's fair to say that Dr. Curran is one of that most welcome band of young historians in Australia who come to conclusions having assessed the evidence, rather than the other way around, which was often the case of historians of my generation
and older who came to the conclusion first and then hunted down a little bit of evidence. But we've seen this in Dr. Curran's previous work on the unknown, Australia after Empire, and now again with this path-breaking book on John Curtin, which is where the author has gone off into the archives and in Australia and in the United States and in Britain and dug around and come up with some evidence to support a very interesting thesis. So, well done. I hope the book's successful. Anne's got some copies over there of Curtin's Empire. No doubt you'll be writing more, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future, but for tonight, well done, and congratulations.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.